From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. We're going to start with the Department of Justice announcement today that it's filed charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The charges came just hours after Assange was arrested in London. He was forcibly led from Ecuador's embassy in London. He's been living there in exile for nearly 7 years. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing joins us from Washington. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Lisa.
So the charges are for conspiracy to commit computer intrusion, and they are connected to leaks from Army Private Chelsea Manning back in 2010. So it's helpful to remember that there is actually a through line from Chelsea Manning to Julian Assange to the Democratic National Committee all the way to Robert Mueller's investigation. How did we get from there to here?
Well, what we know today is that back in that previous life in 2010, then Army Private Bradley Manning, as she was at the time, gave to WikiLeaks a great deal of classified material from the U.S. government, the Defense Department, the Department of State, which WikiLeaks then released to great reception around the world, to great criticism, to great acclaim, because it revealed the practices of the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan. It revealed the practices of diplomacy by the United States around the world. There were many cables sent from American embassies and other diplomatic posts to Washington and back. And so we learned a ton of material about the conduct of American officialdom from Manning and WikiLeaks. And it put Assange and WikiLeaks in a position of being these arbiters of classified information. WikiLeaks steals secrets, as its tagline was at the time. And the Russian government, according to Special Counsel Robert Mueller, tried to take advantage of that evidently independent imprimatur that WikiLeaks gave to the release of leaked materials in 2016 as part of its campaign to interfere in the U.S. presidential election. What prosecutors have said is that the Russian intelligence agency, the GRU, stole a whole bunch of data from political targets in the United States, including the leadership of the Democratic Party, the leadership of Hillary Clinton's campaign, gave it to Julian Assange. WikiLeaks then released it to cause great disruption in the United States, and that brings us up to today.
Okay, with the Mueller investigation, the full Mueller investigation yet to be released, but clearly this is all going to be playing into what happens as a result of the release and the investigation. Back today, back to what happened in London, Ecuador's embassy gave Assange asylum back in 2012. At the time, Sweden wanted him on rape and sexual assault charges. Sweden has since rescinded that arrest, but the U.S. does want him, has charged him with conspiracy. What do you make of those particular charges?
The substance of the charges in the indictment unsealed today is that Assange worked with Manning to violate the security of U.S. government computer systems. And specifically, there's some details about how Assange might have helped Manning with Linux or with the cracking of passwords to get access to the material that WikiLeaks later obtained and released. Prosecutors may have made that choice because there's been a great deal of debate about Assange and WikiLeaks and about whether he is a journalist and whether WikiLeaks is a media organization and accordingly whether they benefit from, in the United States, the First Amendment and in the rest of the world, various nations' laws that protect press freedoms. The Justice Department appears to have decided to try to sidestep that and make this case against Assange not about the publication of information but about the way in which it was obtained. In other words, he allegedly helped Manning hack a U.S. government computer system. That's against the law, and that's the substance of this indictment.
When Chelsea Manning was with the U.S. military. So the United States Justice Department wants Assange extradited to the U.S. If that does happen, if he is tried here, what information could he provide that investigators are looking for?
That's a great question. And one other thing that is not clear is whether this will be the end to the charges brought by the Justice Department against Assange. There's been a lot of indications about a lot of work behind the scenes by investigators involving him in his case. And in fact, Chelsea Manning herself is in custody today, from what we understand, because a grand jury in the Eastern District of Virginia is working on some kind of case that we believe relates to WikiLeaks and Assange. And Manning declined to testify before that grand jury, even though she'd been served with a subpoena. And a judge sent her to jail for her refusal to do so. But that suggests that there could be another indictment or a superseding indictment involving Assange at some point in the future that might bring a case that relates to the 2016 election interference in addition to the one that prosecutors already have made related to those 2010 alleged offenses that involved the computer hacking from Bradley Manning at the time and the relates to the U.S. government information.
Phil, President Trump has weighed in today. He at one time said he loved WikiLeaks. That was when the organization was leaking information about Democrats before the election. He referred to that. Today, though, the president said, "I know nothing about WikiLeaks. It's not my thing." His Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, though, when he was director of the CIA, called WikiLeaks a non-state hostile intelligence service, often abetted by state actors like Russia. So if Assange comes to the United States, how can we expect the Trump administration and the Department of Justice to handle this case?
It's going to be a very interesting storyline. What the president seemed to be saying at the White House this morning was that he hasn't been involved with whatever day-to-day decisions are being made at the Justice Department about this particular case. The president said that what happens next will be up to the Attorney General, Bill Barr, suggesting that he hasn't been involved or he might not have been read in before the fact when these events took place this morning. We don't know the backstory yet in terms of what has been taking place behind the scenes, but there could be a little bit of political awkwardness, as you suggest, because in 2016, Trump and his supporters were great fans of Assange and WikiLeaks, separate and apart from the way they, according to their argument, obtained the material that they released, but for the substance of what it contained. And Trump's point always was, who knows how Assange got the material? We now know he got it from Russian cyber attacks, but look at what it says. It revealed the clubbiness between reporters and Clinton's campaign leaders, for example. It revealed the way Democrats at the top of the party leadership were talking about the way they wanted the nomination to work. That was very helpful for Republicans at the time. The question now is, what will the president, what will Mike Pompeo and others say if Assange comes to the United States and actually stands trial in open court?
Thank you. NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing, thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, the check-in now on the 2020 presidential race and Andrew Yang, who may be one of the Democratic hopefuls you don't yet recognize. He wants to decriminalize possession and use of small amounts of non-prescribed opioids, lower the voting age to 16. He says all Americans 18 and over need a raise. Yang is basing his entire campaign on this universal basic income, and he's testing his so-called freedom dividend by giving a family in New Hampshire $1,000 a month, no strings attached, for all of 2019. He's getting attention. Here's New Hampshire Public Radio's Robert Garova.
2 years ago, Charles Fassey of Goffstown, New Hampshire, lost his job as a manager at a company that services chemical dispensing equipment. He says he'd worked there for 13 years.
And then, I was just, suddenly let go. And, it felt like, it was definitely connected between automation and, companies kind of putting less value on human capital, I would say.
His wife Jody says the loss of income came at a really hard time for the rest of the family, including their daughter Janelle, who was going into her freshman year at a private college.
He lost his job like August 11th, and she was starting college that week. We had to set up her dorm. I actually had this house on the market. I had his car sold. I mean, I just went into protective mode of, okay, well, what do I need to do to keep her in college?
Janelle was the one who put her family in the running for the dividend from the presidential candidate Andrew Yang. She filled out an online form last year, and then her family was interviewed by Yang. When they got the call they'd been picked for the bonus, Jody says Charles was stunned.
And he actually ended up crying because he felt like we didn't deserve it. That's my husband.
When Yang was in New Hampshire last spring, he explained why he's doing this.
The goal is to illustrate the impact that $1,000 a month can have on a family or a household here in New Hampshire. And putting my money where my mouth is.
The idea behind Yang's freedom dividend is nothing new. It's his take on what's known as universal basic income, or the idea that everyone gets a set amount of money from the government. Tech executives Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk have expressed interest in the concept, and Stockton, California just became the first U.S. city to provide universal basic income, or UBI, to some residents. Here's Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs.
$500, no strings attached. The idea is to have a conversation about kind of the economic system of this country.
Politicians in New Hampshire are more likely to upplay the state's booming economy than question it altogether. Charles Fassey says while he's got a new job, he says he's making a lot less than before.
The stock market's up, businesses are raking in profits, yet people are kind of struggling more and more every day.
The Fassey family hasn't figured out exactly what they'll do with the extra income. Jody says she can think of a few things.
Yeah. Just the basic security of having, a little extra money that if a car breaks, we don't have to use our credit card, we can actually pay.
Daughter Janelle says she thinks of it like an education fund.
It's kind of like a scholarship in a way, especially for college students.
And Charles says it's making him think a little more creatively.
Even, yeah. You know, we were talking about starting our own business, you know, and, you know, I gonna, you know, hopefully we can try to do something good with the money in that year to improve our lives a bit.
The Fassi family says Yang hasn't asked them to provide any plan on how they'll spend the money. But is the idea of a candidate giving money to a potential voter to be considered vote buying? Northwestern Pritzker School of Law professor Michael Kang says because there doesn't seem to be a quid pro quo arrangement here, it should be legal.
As far as I can tell from the facts, there's no agreement that they're going to vote, and they didn't say how they're going to vote or anything like that. It doesn't seem to me to raise a vote buying concern.
The Yang campaign says they spent a lot of time with their attorneys checking on the legality of their plan, and it's their understanding that the dividend complies with election law. The New Hampshire Attorney General's office says there are currently no complaints against the Yang campaign. For Here and Now, I'm Robert Garova.
Fascinating. We'll see how that plays out. Poor Emily Dickinson, writing her little poems on the back of gingerbread recipes in her bedroom in Amherst, Massachusetts, hoping no one would ever see them or her, a spinster recluse, an apparition flitting about in white. While her brother Austin and his wife Sue entertained next door, Emily, poor thing, was a shriveling, stern-faced wallflower. Not. In the new film Wild Nights with Emily, Dickinson, played by Molly Shannon, is a woman desperate to be published, passionate for her work, as she tells Atlantic Monthly editor Thomas Higginson, played by Brett Gelman.
If I feel physically like the top of my head is taken off, I know that is poetry. If it makes my body so cold no fire can ever warm me, I know that is poetry.
Oh, and her speaking is poetry, except he doesn't get it.
When I read your poems, so many of them make me feel unclear. I believe poetry should leave you with a trembling sensation. But when I read your poetry, Miss Dickinson, I'm left feeling I'm not sure what.
Well, Emily Dickinson is also passionate for her lifelong love, her aforementioned brother's wife, Sue, a childhood friend who conveniently married him so that she and Emily could live next door to each other and carry on their then forbidden love. And guess what? This is all just about true. Wild Nights with Emily star Molly Shannon joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Hi there.
Hi, Robin.
And she is with her friend since their days at NYU, writer and director Madeline Olneck. Madeline, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And Molly, I want to start with you. Did you know about Emily's airbrushed history?
No. You know, I, like a lot of people, just grew up with that notion that she was a very frightened woman who spoke to people through walls with no desire to have her voice heard in her lifetime, wanting her poetries burned upon her death. So I have to be honest, I wasn't that interested in her. I was like, ooh. And then Madeline and I, with this movie, really wanted to tell the truth about her life, that these notions that we have about her just are not true.
Yeah. Well, Madeline, you've said you were an English major in college and didn't even know Dickinson was a lesbian poet. Why is this story important for people to know, that she did want to be published, that she did have passion?
One reason it's important for me is she's held up as one of our country's greatest poets. And a lot of people look to her and they look to how she lived to give them a path. What was interesting was that after the first book of Emily Dickinson's poems came out, and this was in the 1890s, women just started showing up at the Dickinson homestead and asking, is this where the lady poet lived? Because they wanted to look and see, literally, how did she live that she was able to create these great poems? How did she do it?
Right.
But it's also important because we're having a cultural moment, I think, since the election of Donald Trump. We're willing to acknowledge as a society that we're all paying a real price for not having truthful and genuine images of women. And a lot of that happens in history, how histories have been erased of women. By restoring Emily, we understand so much about what her journey was like as a writer, and she becomes an actual person to us as opposed to
a myth.
A very twisted, yes, myth.
Well, and you say part of the problem is that the image that was given of, was of someone who didn't want her work to be published, kind of kept her head down, was a good little girl, didn't claim her stuff as being any good. And, of course, that's not true at all, and that's not the message that you want to send to young women. So let's explain right at the start what scholars now think happened here. And first we'll listen to another scene, because the centerpiece of your film is Emily's passionate relationship with Sue, her sister-in-law, Susan Gilbert, played in the film by Susan Ziegler. In this scene, Emily asks Susan to be more careful about their relationship. Let's listen.
I have to be more careful? You are the one who writes the poems, puts it in ink. Sue forevermore. You think that has another meaning? Sue forevermore. That hardly speaks to the larger audience.
So there's Emily trying to say, no, it speaks to the larger audience. No, it doesn't. It speaks to Sue. But there was another woman that began having an affair with Austin, Emily's brother, Sue's husband. Her name is Mabel. And she's the one who takes over the letters and poems of Emily Dickinson after she dies and literally erases the Sue.
She also often, when she would come across a word she didn't like in Emily's poems, she would just change that word. Mm-hmm. And she put titles on the poems in Emily Dickinson.
She never wanted titles.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now science is allowing us to understand new things about historical figures with their spectrographic technologies, which is used to examine the erasures that were in her poems, that Sue's name was actually erased.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
And so it just teaches us all this stuff now that we might not have known about some great historical figures.
Yeah. Well, Molly Shannon, you have to play her in the film as both narratives, both Emily Dickinson's, one as seen through the eyes of Mabel later as she went on the speaking tour and was telling people about the Emily Dickinson that was the recluse, and we see flashes to you in this with a stern face. And then the other Emily Dickinson that's revealed by these letters and, you know, in this fun, passionate relationship with Sue. There's moments like she comes in and tells Sue, you know, I just haven't been able to write any poems, I haven't been able to work. And then she starts pulling them, out of her hair?
Mm-hmm.
Parts of her dress where they're all over her on these little scraps of paper. Talk about, you know, how you wanted to be Emily Dickinson. How you wanted to embody her.
Well, I think she was so hungry to be published. You know, it's important to shed light on the fact that Emily Dickinson was this super gifted writer who was experiencing rejection at many levels. So this could now serve as an empowering role model to modern female writers with similar struggles currently. She was really actively, you know, making little poetry books, meeting with Higginson, just really hungry to get published. But this image that we had of her as if she was a frightened woman who spoke to people through walls is just not correct. And I think the idea that we have of her, that she didn't want to be published, sabotages women today who are struggling to get their voices heard. When in reality, she's a real LGBTQ role model, trailblazer, hero.
Well, and yes. I thought of you because first of all, we know you from not just your films, the comedy Divorce, the drama Other People, but of course Saturday Night Live. And there's one moment where your character Emily Dickinson is meeting with the Atlantic editor in her sitting room. And I swear, Molly Shannon, I could see a glimpse of your cheerleader.
Oh, that's so funny.
When she got excited. But also, we know that the early days of SNL, it was tough for the women. I mean, most women, no matter what field, you've experienced this, but did you relate to it on that level?
I really did, Robin. When I first started SNL, I had actually, Madeline and I went to NYU Drama School together, and I created Mary Catherine Gallagher in an exercise. Madeline directed and wrote this show called The Follies. And she was like, just make up a character and come through the door. Make up any character you want, and I'm going to be this tough director. And I just made up, hi, I'm Mary Catherine Gallagher. And that's how the character was created. So to make a long story short, years later, cut to, I'd been developing that character after NYU in stage shows. And then when I got to Saturday Night Live, I knew that character worked because I'd done it in a stage show. But I was like, trying to get it on air, and I would show the character to writers, and I'd show the sketch, and they'd go, you know, the reason this can't work is because this isn't really a joke. So I was a lot like Emily Dickinson, and then I brought it to another guy, and I said, I do this character in my show, and they go, it's not going to work because of this. They ended up putting it in the show, but I think they didn't really know what it was going to be physically. So I remember for the dress rehearsal, it was like at the bottom of the, you know, they put, for the dress rehearsal, they put the sketches they think are the hottest at the top, and then they put the stuff they're not as into at the bottom. So it was at the very bottom, and I went on, and it went great. It just went so well. And then I remember going into Lorne Michaels' office between dress and air, when you see what's made it onto the live show, you see the cuts and then what's made it. And Mary Catherine Gallagher got moved from the bottom of the show to the top. And I was like, yes. So the scene where Emily is trying to sell herself to Higginson, of course I relate to that. I relate to her hunger, you know. She sent 90 poems to Higginson, who was the editor of the Atlantic Monthly. She made DIY poetry books. She sent a huge amount of work in the mail to the Roberts brothers. She was up against the male establishment, the oppressive, sexist establishment. And so we really examined this sexism through the lens of comedy.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
Well, two things. First of all, you might stay in your room if that was happening to you, if you were Emily Dickinson and you knew you were Emily Dickinson and most of your stuff wasn't getting published. And ladies and gentlemen, we have just drawn the line from Mary Catherine Gallagher to, you know, hope is the thing with feathers. And I just, you know, we talk about what happened, but can we just take a second? Do you each have, are there lines of hers? Are there, you know, having made the film, is there, you know, poetry that just jumps to mind?
I can wade grief, whole pools of it. I'm used to that, but the least push of joy breaks up my feet, and I tip drunken. Let no pebble smile. 'Twas the new liquor, that was all.
You must let me go first, Sue, because I live in the sea always and know the road. I would have drowned twice to save you sinking, dear, if I could only have covered your eyes. You wouldn't have seen the water. That is the most beautiful poem. Mm. That's my favorite.
And that's Molly Shannon, the star, the Emily Dickinson in Wild Nights with Emily. We've also been speaking with writer-director and Molly's friend from NYU days, Madeline Olneck. Thank you so much. Can't wait to see what you guys do next. Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave, control your comfort.
Thousands of employees of Amazon are increasing the pressure on the company to double down on its commitment to fight climate change. As of this morning, more than 4,000 employees had added their names to a letter published on Medium. It asks CEO Jeff Bezos and the Amazon Board of Directors to set a hard public timeline for goals such as cutting greenhouse gas emissions. For more on that, let's bring in Robin Farzad, a host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
What exactly do the employees want Amazon to do?
For starters, to stop provisioning companies that extract fossil fuels, and the workers are also calling Amazon out on not having yet disclosed a company-wide plan to reach zero carbon emissions within the timeline required by science. Another grievance was that Amazon was donating to 68 members of Congress who voted against climate legislation 100% of the time. So these employees are really calling management out on this.
So if they want reduced waste, for instance, I mean, probably many people listening in the audience will have received an Amazon package, maybe in some cases much larger than the item inside. We can only imagine the kind of waste that is produced. Are the things that the employees are calling for possible?
On this scale, what they're calling for, kind of, you know, shut it down right now, provide this information right now, I don't imagine that it's available overnight. A company as huge as Amazon could, in theory, take the lead. As the letter itself from the workers puts it, and I'm quoting, Amazon has the resources and scale to spark the world's imagination and redefine what is possible and necessary to address the climate crisis, close quote. But you'd then have competitors pouncing on the businesses you boycott. Oracle, the tech giant, advertises against Amazon on the back of major magazines every week. We know the Chinese will work with anyone. Amazon is a competitive and hungry behemoth. that isn't about to lose business.
And there is pressure because this is the bigger story behind the letter. Late last year, a small group of Amazon employees filed what's known as an activist shareholder proposal. Describe what that is and how that connects to the letter that we're talking about today.
Yeah, I mean, shareholder democracy in the United States is not the most efficacious route. Oftentimes, resolutions are non-binding, and you can never hope to get the tens of millions of shares worth of votes held by the huge index fund and mutual fund shops who most often they just end up rubber stamping management and boards. But the action that you saw with that letter and what you saw today, they do get press and notice, and they're sometimes the opening shot in a bigger movement, especially if a fund company or a bigger investor comes on board and says, yes, I'm going to use my moral suasion to get what we want.
Right. So it's becoming increasingly common for employees in the tech industry to get stock as part of their compensation. But how common is it for them to use their shareholder status in this way of exerting this kind of pressure?
Not all that common just yet. There's always fear of retaliation or running afoul of non-disparagement agreements that you tied to your bonuses. I mean, initially when you signed at these companies, some outsiders deride this behavior as entitlement. The employees themselves, correctly, they see themselves as both stakeholders and shareholders. We're building the code, for example, the programmers at Amazon, and don't want the fruits of our labor to go to industries or practices that we ultimately oppose.
We only have a few, probably about a half minute left for this, but the proposal is lofty, but there are Amazon board members who say, look, a corporation's sole purpose is not just to maximize profit anymore. That's inadequate. So does this stand a chance? Very briefly.
I mean, for this to happen, you need mom and pop investors to start scrutinizing their portfolios and then engaging with multi-trillion dollar fund houses to use their suasion or else. Or this is really nowhere close to that.
Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
The first blooms of spring are getting buried by snow in the central parts of the country. It's another bomb cyclone blizzard. This one hit the Rocky Mountains yesterday, and it's spinning into the plains and Midwest, where meteorologists say wind gusts are reaching up to 60 miles an hour. Snowfall could be historic for this time of year. Jay Trobeck is chief meteorologist at KELO-TV in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, or Kelloland, as they call it in the five states it serves. Jay, remind us, we had another bomb cyclone in March. What is this thing?
Well, this thing's a big wet spring storm that's affecting most of this area in the upper Midwest with a variety of weather issues. We have a blizzard going with lots of snow and wind in western, central, northeastern South Dakota into western Minnesota. In southeastern South Dakota, northwest Iowa, southwest Minnesota, we actually have an ice storm going on at the present time. The rest of the area, just plain lots of snow and lots of wind. It's not a great day to be outdoors.
No, it's not. And it's called a bomb cyclone, I think we remember, because of how quickly this pressure drops.
Yes. And I mentioned before that we have the center of the storm is kind of right where Minnesota, Iowa, and Nebraska all meet with South Dakota, right in that area is where the center of the storm is. And in those areas, that's where we've seen the thunder and the lightning. At times, it's almost been like a severe thunderstorm right in those areas. So we're seeing lots of icing in these areas as well with the strong winds. It's kind of an odd situation. If you look at some of the trees, on the east side of trees, you'll see ice and icicles hanging off the trees. And it's like the wind has pushed them flat with the ice that's already occurred in those areas.
Boy, a couple of things. First of all, listeners, we'd love to see pictures. You know, send them to our comment section to see, you know, how this is affecting you, please, hereandnow.org. But you mentioned the thunder. I know it's dangerous, but I love thunder snow. It's such an odd apocalyptic feeling thing. but this is, I mean, you know, this is serious. Officials have closed Interstate 80 in Nebraska. You mentioned that area. You know, they're warning it's going to be dangerous. Yesterday, we spoke to people in Iowa who haven't gotten over the flooding from a month ago, and now they're worried about all of this melting and coming down again into their town, Hamburg, Iowa. So, I mean, so many concerns. What is your sense? I actually think that in some areas in where you are, you went from 70 degrees to 20 degrees in just one day. What is coming? I mean, how much of this snow is going to melt?
Well, this thing is moving very slowly, kind of in a northwest direction right now, a little odd, but what's going to happen here is we're just going to get more snowfall. We expect the snow to continue the rest of today and wind down from west to east during the morning hours of tomorrow. So a lot of folks are going to end up in that 2-foot range of snowfall. Wow. And here in the the southeastern tip of South Dakota, we're seeing some decent icing that's going to be followed by the snow as the rain changes over to snow tonight. Fortunately, the weekend is looking dry. A lot of folks are going to be spending it shoveling.
Well, and you mentioned the ice with the snow on top of it. That's what led to so much flooding a few weeks back in parts of the country because the water had nowhere to go. But you're talking about 2 feet of snow. You know, we've had snow. We're in New England. We've had snow in May. I mean, that's happened. But 2 feet of snow in April. Put this in context. Have you seen this?
Yeah, we kind of get these freak storms in April sometimes. In fact, this is the week. 6 years ago this week, we had a devastating ice storm affecting many parts of South Dakota, including the Sioux Falls area. 1 year ago this week, we had a devastating blizzard. And I think right now I'm going to mark my calendar this week next year. Just plan on working.
Yeah,
because
work.
This seems to be the week for big storms around here.
Right. And just to, for these people who are dreading the snow melt and the flooding that that will cause, when do you expect the temperatures to go back up again?
Well, it's going to be, because we now have a snowpack on the ground, it's going to hold down our heating a little bit. We do expect to get into at least the 30s this weekend to get the slow snow melt going.
Good.
And that's what you like. You like to have a slow snow melt,
right.
And it does look like we have kind of that in the forecast. And, well, we'll just deal with it. Hopefully we'll get into some spring here because it has been a long and brutal winter around here.
Yeah, but you don't want it too fast because of the flooding. Jabe Trobeck, chief meteorologist at Keloland TV in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Jay, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, now let's check in again on Mozambique. It's been nearly a month since the real cyclone Idai brought torrential rains and strong winds to southern Africa, killing at least 847 people across Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi. Massive floods just swallowed large swaths of land, and now there's the predicted shortage of food and the threat of even more disease. There's already a cholera outbreak. Chance Briggs is the country director for Save the Children in Mozambique. He joins us now by Skype from the capital, Maputo. Chance, give us the thumbnail. The last time we checked, there were still bodies floating, terrible flooding. What's going on?
The situation is still very, very bad, and I think the Southern Hemisphere has never really seen something like this in a natural disaster. Mm-hmm. We estimate about 2 million people have been affected just in Mozambique, of which 1 million are children. We still have people who are surrounded by waters in their communities, but many others are just trying to pick up the pieces. We have 100,000 or more who were displaced, and many of them are living in tented camps, but some are just set up at the side of the road with whatever they can find to cover their heads. Mm. It's really still a dire situation, and we're worried.
Well, we understand the city of Beira was almost completely wiped out, 90% of the city's infrastructure gone. So you've got to have a refugee issue.
Yes, Beira took a very heavy hit, but I think I can say that the local authorities and supported by the international community have done a great job in restoring electricity and water and basic services, basic infrastructure. The real problem in Beira, and as in many places across the whole zone where there were heavy rains, is that the roofs would be pulled off of the houses, and then people whose houses were made of mud bricks would literally see their houses melt in front of them. There were also falling trees and power lines, and so there are many, many risks and dangers.
Yeah. Well, they are also expect floods in that area. There's drainage canals, retention systems. Wind, as you say, was the factor because it was a cyclone, and so roofs were ripped off. It doesn't seem like, short of completely changing construction in the country, you can do anything about that.
Well, it's true. There are better ways to construct, but it takes funds that most poor Mozambican families don't have. And Mozambique is about the 10th poorest country in the world with a 50% poverty rate. Mm-hmm. So that's a big challenge that this country will face as it continues to face climate shocks with climate change making things worse.
Well, yeah, there's that. So tell us what's happening with the cholera outbreak.
So the cholera outbreak is a big concern, but I'm happy to say that almost 900,000 doses of the vaccine have been administered over the past week. In addition, we and other agencies have volunteers going door to door to tell people about cholera to make sure that they understand how to prevent it, because it's a very preventable disease with good hygiene and good sanitation. In addition, cholera treatment centers are being set up, and we ourselves are setting up a cholera treatment unit so that those who do come down with the disease can quickly get suitable treatment, because it is a very treatable disease.
How do you treat it?
Basically, you get people oral rehydration, so you get water back into their bodies. You get them a bit of medicine if they need it, and they need rest. And most people recover fine. It's the children and the elderly and people with other underlying medical conditions who are the most vulnerable, and they're the ones we need to get into the centers the soonest.
You know, Chance, I don't mean to be at all flip, but this storm, I mean, the pictures that we saw, it's just devastating. And not just Mozambique. The UN counted at least 250 who've died in Zimbabwe. Dozens have died in Malawi. You know, the body count continues in Mozambique. And yet it's almost like those children's toys. They stand up and when you knock them, they fall down, but they stand back up, you know. And there's this feeling that, well, they will just stand back up. Do you ever have a sense that maybe a country can't get up from a hit like this?
Well, Mozambicans are very resilient despite their poverty. I do believe that the people and the country will pick themselves up with significant assistance from the international community. What I do have to say is that right now funding is the urgent need. There's a big appeal for funds, and we are probably only 21% funded across the humanitarian sector. And if we don't get people quickly back on their feet now, they will have trouble recovering, reconstructing their houses, reconstructing their livelihoods, because most people are farmers here. They need to get back to their fields. They need seeds. They need tools. And in the very, very short term, they need food and they need shelter. We're working on that, but funds are what's lacking.
Chance Briggs, Country Director for Save the Children in Mozambique. Chance, thank you so much for bringing us up to date on, you know, really a month later, what a horrendous situation there after Cyclone Idai. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Robin.
Outsider art is having an in moment. Outsider is a label given to self-taught, unconventional, and often uncelebrated artists. But in recent months, there have been exhibitions of outsider art at the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and Atlanta's High Museum of Art. While mainstream interest is on the rise, the genre has always been in the spotlight at Intuit, the Center for Intuitive and Outsider Art. It's a small gallery founded in Chicago in 1991, and it's one of the few museums in the world dedicated solely to outsider art. Here and Now's Chris Bentley went there.
Deb Carr stands in an empty gallery, her voice bouncing off freshly painted white walls. She's the executive director of Intuit, and she's helping set up for a new exhibit showing the work of Susan Teka Hurangi King.
And she does these incredible drawings where she sort of deconstructs popular culture. So there's some deconstructed Donald Ducks in some of her art. She is someone who is on the autism spectrum, and she does not speak, but the art speaks for her, I think, in very powerful ways.
Carr says good art always speaks for itself. But outsider art is as much about the story of the artist behind it as what's on the canvas. Outsider artists, sometimes called folk artists, are usually self-taught and often have had to overcome some hardship to create and exhibit their work.
These are people who are so driven to create. They're compelled to create. And without even having access to fancy art supplies, sometimes they just create with whatever is to hand. This is art that really speaks to regular people, and they don't have to have any art background or training to be engaged with it. And I think that's really exciting and important.
Take Henry Darger, one of the genre's best-known names. In January, one of his works sold for nearly $700,000 at a Christie's auction in New York. Darger worked as a janitor in a Chicago hospital and spent his free time writing a kind of graphic novel, thousands of pages long and full of vibrant watercolors, depicting a fantastical battle between good and evil. But he was a recluse, and his work wasn't discovered until just before his death in 1973. Intuit acquired much of Darger's collection and even recreated the artist's apartment inside their gallery.
And here we are. I'm going to take down the velvet rope, invite you in, and here we are, surrounded by the belongings of Henry Darger.
It's a small, dimly lit room with Darger's Remington typewriter and Victrola record player. There are a few tables piled high with bundles of old magazines, boxes of crayons, and stacks of diaries.
He was a trash picker, and there's a lot of stuff in here. Here you go. This is people are always wowed by this. This is a small box filled with small rubber bands, labeled small rubber bands. Here's another box filled with small rubber bands. And over on his table, there is a box full of large rubber bands.
Darger never exhibited his work. And even if he had wanted to, he might have struggled to find an outlet. But today, because of museums like Intuit, it's easier for outsider artists to find an audience. Artists like Robert Johnson and E. Nix, whose work is on display now at the Chicago Gallery. Nix says he's always felt compelled to make art.
As far as I can remember, I've always been making things. I've always done things with my hands. I've always drawn, especially. I don't have a formal education in art, so I kind of had to do this on my own through just experimentation, reading books, but a lot of experimentation.
Nix apprenticed as a blacksmith and uses those skills in multimedia sculptures that deal with themes of trauma and addiction. His self-portrait is a sculpture subtitled Pinocchio. It's made out of found objects, old school chairs for legs, nails hammered into shoulders, and empty plastic bottles of methadone inside his torso. Nix says he's never considered himself an outsider artist, but he's okay with the label.
For me, it's not a powerful label. You know, it's not something that moves me in either direction. But I have no problem being considered an outsider artist. I'm considered an outsider everything else anyway, so why not add art to it?
Another outsider artist, Robert Johnson, is best known for his reverse oil paintings done on salvaged windows.
So I painted on the other side, and then it's meant to be viewed from the opposite side.
And where do you find the windows?
I found them all over Chicago, mainly from buildings that were being rehabbed. You just drive up, and they just give them away.
Images of guns and bags of white powder evoke Johnson's past struggles with addiction. His newer work is full of brightly colored skulls and grinding gears inspired by his time as an army mechanic in Iraq. Johnson says making art is like a form of therapy.
I can just empty my mind. I can forget about the stresses I'm dealing with on a daily basis and just open up. So it helps me manage all the jumble of thoughts in my head, the anger and things like that. I can just put it out right into the canvas, right into a piece.
Like Nix, Johnson is also ambivalent about being labeled an outsider artist. But he says people in the traditional art world never really made him feel welcome.
Oh, you made it into this gallery, or where were you schooled at? And you got your, I got my sculpting degree, I have my MFA, I have this. Well, okay, does that lessen somebody who doesn't have that? I don't really think so, but so far in the art world, unfortunately, that's the way it's been working.
That's the way it's been working, except in museums like Intuit that blur the line between who's considered part of the art world and who's outside it. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Bentley.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.